man is at the wheel and seems to lead it, but the car does not drive in the desired direction. It moves as another force pushes.
Who is behind it? Representative Lewis T. McFadden, the chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee, throughout the 1920s and into the Great Depression years of the 1930s, explained it this way.
The course of Russian history has indeed been greatly affected by the operations of international bankers. The Soviet government has been given United States Treasury funds by the Federal Reserve Board, acting through the Chase Bank. England has drawn money from us through the Federal Reserve Banks and has relent it at high rates of interest to the Soviet government. The Dnipro Tory Dam was built with funds unlawfully taken from the United States Treasury by the corrupt and dishonest Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Bank.
In other words, the Fed and the Bank of England, at the behest of the international bankers who controlled them, were creating a monster, one which would fuel 7 decades of unprecedented communist revolution, warfare, and most importantly, debt. In case you think there's some chance that the money changers got communism going and then lost control, in 1992, the Washington Times reported that Russian President Boris Yeltsin was upset that most of the incoming foreign aid was being siphoned off, quote, straight back into the coffers of Western banks in debt service, close quote. No one in his right mind would claim that a war as large as World War I had a single cause. Wars are complex things with many causative factors. But on the other hand, it would also be equally foolish to ignore as a prime cause of World War I those who would profit the most from the war. The role of the money changers is no wild conspiracy theory. They had a motive, a short-range, self-serving motive, as well as a long-range political motive of advancing totalitarian government, with the money changers maintaining the financial clout to control whatever politician might emerge as the leader. Next, we'll see what the money changers' ultimate political goal is for the world. Shortly after World War I, the overall political agenda of the money changers began to be clear. Now that they controlled national economies individually, the next step was the ultimate form of consolidation, world government. The new world government proposal was given top priority at the Paris Peace Conference after World War I. It was called the League of Nations. But much to the surprise of Paul Warburg and Bernard Baruch, who attended the peace conference with President Wilson, the world was not yet ready to dissolve national boundaries. Nationalism still beats strong in the human breast. For example, Lord Curzon, the British Foreign Secretary, called the League of Nations a good joke, even though it was the stated policy of the British government to support it. To the humiliation of President Wilson, the U.S. Congress wouldn't ratify the League either, despite the fact that it had been ratified by many other nations. Without money flowing from the U.S. Treasury, the League died. After World War I, the American public had grown tired of the internationalist policies of Democrat Woodrow Wilson. In the presidential election of 1920, Republican Warren Harding won a landslide victory with over 60% of the vote. Harding was an ardent foe of both Bolshevism and the League of Nations. His election, which opened a 12-year run of Republican presidents in the White House, led to an unprecedented era of prosperity known as the Roaring Twenties. Despite the fact that the war had brought America a debt 10 times larger than its Civil War debt, still the American economy surged. Gold had poured into the country during the war, and it continued to do so afterwards. In the early 1920s, the governor of this bank, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, a man named Benjamin Strong, met frequently with the secretive and eccentric governor of the Bank of England, Montague Norman. Norman was determined to replace the gold England had lost to the U.S. during World War I and return the Bank of England to its former position of dominance in world finance. On top of that, rich with gold, the American economy might get out of control again, just like it had done after the Civil War. During the next 8 years, under the presidencies of Harding and Coolidge, the huge federal debt built up during World War I was cut by 38%, down to $16 billion, the greatest percentage drop in U.S. history. During the election of 1920, Warren Harding and Calvin Coolidge ran against James Cox, the governor of Ohio, and the little-known Franklin D. Roosevelt, who had previously risen to no higher post than President Wilson's Assistant Secretary of the Navy. After his inauguration, Harding moved quickly to formally kill the League of Nations. Then he quickly moved to reduce domestic taxes while raising tariffs to record heights. Now, this was a revenue policy of which most of the founding fathers would certainly have approved. His second year in office, Harding took ill on a train trip in the West and suddenly died. Although no autopsy was performed, the cause was said to be either pneumonia or food poisoning. When Coolidge took over, he continued Harding's domestic economic policy of high tariffs on imports while cutting income taxes. As a result, the economy grew at such a rate that net revenue still increased. Now that had to be stopped. So just as they'd done so frequently before, the money changers decided it was time to crash the American economy. The Federal Reserve began flooding the country with money. They increased the money supply by 62% during these years. Money was plentiful. This is why it was known as the Roaring Twenties. Before his death in 1919, former President Teddy Roosevelt warned the American people what was going on. As reported in the March 27, 1922 edition of the New York Times, Roosevelt said, "These international bankers and Rockefeller Standard Oil interests control the majority of newspapers and the columns of these papers to club into submission or drive out of public office officials who refuse to do the bidding of the powerful, corrupt clique which compose the invisible government." Just one day before, in the New York Times, the mayor of New York, John Hyland, quoted Roosevelt and blasted those he saw as taking control of America, its political machinery, and its press. The warning of Theodore Roosevelt has much timeliness today, for the real menace of our republic is this invisible government which, like a giant octopus, sprawls its slimy length over city, state, and nation. It seizes in its long and powerful tentacles our executive offices, our legislative bodies, our schools, our courts, our newspapers, and every agency created for the public protection. To depart from mere generalizations, let me say that at the head of this octopus are the Rockefeller Standard Oil interests and a small group of powerful banking houses generally referred to as the international bankers. The little coterie of powerful international bankers virtually run the United States government for their own selfish purposes. They practically control both parties, write political platforms, make cat's paws of party leaders, use the leading men of private organizations, and resort to every device to place a nomination for high public office only such candidates as will be amenable to the dictates of corrupt big business. These international bankers and Rockefeller Standard Oil interests control the majority of newspapers and magazines in this country. Why didn't people listen to such strong warnings and demand that Congress reverse its 1913 passage of the Federal Reserve Act? Because remember, it was the 1920s. A steady increase in bank loans contributed to a rising market. In other words, just as it is today, in times of prosperity, no one wants to worry about economic issues. But there was a dark side to all this prosperity. Businesses expanded and became strung out on credit. Speculation in the booming stock market became rampant. Although everything looked rosy, it was a castle made of sand. When all was in readiness, in April of 1929, Paul Warburg, the father of the Federal Reserve, sent out a secret advisory warning his friends that a collapse and nationwide depression was certain. In August of 1929, the Fed began to tighten money. It is not a coincidence that the biographies of all the Wall Street giants of that era, John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, Bernard Baruch, etc., all marvel that they got out of the stock market just before the crash and put all their assets in cash or gold. On October 24, 1929, the big New York bankers called in their 24-hour broker call loans. This meant that both stockbrokers and customers had to dump their stocks on the market to cover their loans, no matter what price they had to sell them for. As a result, the market tumbled, and that day was known as Black Thursday. According to John Kenneth Galbraith, writing in The Great Crash, 1929, at the height of the selling frenzy, Bernard Baruch brought Winston Churchill into the visitors' gallery of the New York Stock Exchange here to witness the panic and impress him with his power over the wild events down on the floor.
Congressman Lewis McFadden, chairman of the House Committee on Banking and Currency from 1920 to 1931, knew who to blame. He accused the Fed and the international bankers of orchestrating the crash.
It was not accidental. It was a carefully contrived occurrence. The international bankers sought to bring about a condition of despair here so that they might emerge as rulers of us all.
But McFadden went even farther. He openly accused them of causing the crash in order to steal America's gold. In February 1931, in the midst of the Depression, he put it this way.
I think it can hardly be disputed that the statesmen and financiers of Europe are ready to take almost any means to reacquire rapidly the gold stock which Europe lost to America as the result of World War I.
Curtis Dahl, a broker for Lehman Brothers, was on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange the day of the crash. In his 1970 book, FDR, My Exploited Father-in-Law, he explained that the crash was triggered by the planned sudden shortage of call money in the New York money market.
Actually, it was the calculated shearing of the public by the world money powers triggered by the planned sudden shortage of call money in the New York money market.
Within a few weeks, $3 billion of wealth simply seemed to vanish. Within a year, $40 billion had been lost.
But did it really disappear, or was it simply consolidated in fewer hands? And what did the Federal Reserve do? Instead of moving to help the economy out by quickly lowering interest rates to stimulate the economy, the Fed continued to brutally contract the money supply further, deepening the depression. Between 1929 and 1933, the Fed reduced the money supply by an additional 33%.
Although most Americans have never heard that the Fed was the cause of the depression, this is well known among top economists. Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist now of Stanford University, said the same thing in a National Public Radio interview in January of 1996.
The Federal Reserve definitely caused the Great Depression by contracting the amount of currency in circulation by one-third from 1929 to 1933.
But the money lost by most Americans during the Depression didn't just vanish. It was just redistributed into the hands of those who had gotten out just before the crash and had purchased gold, which is always a safe place to put your money just before a Depression. But America's money also went overseas. Incredibly, as President Hoover was heroically trying to rescue banks and prop up businesses, with millions of Americans starving as the Great Depression deepened, millions of dollars were being spent rebuilding Germany from damage sustained during World War I.
8 years before Hitler would invade Poland, Representative Lewis McFadden, chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee, warned Congress that Americans were paying for Hitler's rise to power.
After World War I, Germany fell into the hands of the German international bankers. Those bankers bought her, and they now own her lock, stock, and barrel. They have purchased her industries. They have mortgages on her soil. They control her production. They control all her public utilities. The international German bankers have subsidized the present government of Germany, and they have also supplied every dollar of the money Adolf Hitler has used in his lavish campaign to build up a threat to the government of Brüning. When Brüning fails to obey the orders of the German international bankers, Hitler is brought forth to scare the Germans into submission. Through the Federal Reserve Board, over $30 billion of dollars of American money has been pumped into Germany. You have all heard of the spending that's taken place in Germany. Modernistic dwellings, her great planetariums, her gymnasiums, her swimming pools, her fine public highways, her perfect factories. All this was done on our money. All this was given to Germany through the Federal Reserve Board. The Federal Reserve Board has pumped so many billions of dollars into Germany that they dare not name the total.
Franklin D. Roosevelt was swept into office during the 1932 presidential election. Once Roosevelt was in office, however, sweeping emergency banking measures were immediately announced, which did nothing but increase the Fed's power over the money supply. Then, and only then, did the Fed finally begin to loosen the purse strings and feed new money out to the starving American people.
At first, Roosevelt railed against the money changers as being the cause of the Depression. Believe it or not, this is what he said on March 4, 1933, in his inaugural address.
Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. The money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization.
But 2 days later, Roosevelt declared a bank holiday and closed all banks. Later that year, Roosevelt outlawed private ownership of all gold bullion and all gold coins with the exception of rare coins. Most of the gold in the hands of the average American was in the form of gold coins. The new decree was, in effect, a confiscation. Those who didn't comply risked as much as 10 years in prison and a $10,000 fine, the equivalent of $100,000 today.
Out in small-town America, some people didn't trust Roosevelt's order. Many were torn between keeping their hard-earned wealth or obeying the government. Those who did turn in their gold were paid the official price for it, $20.66 per ounce.
So unpopular was the confiscation order that no one anywhere in government would take credit for authoring it. No congressman claimed it. At the signing ceremony, President Roosevelt made it clear to all present that he was not the author of it and publicly stated that he had not ever read it. Even his Secretary of the Treasury said he'd never read it either, saying it was, quote, what the experts wanted. Roosevelt convinced the public to give up their gold by saying that pooling the nation's resources was necessary to get America out of the Depression. With great fanfare, he ordered a new bullion depository built to hold the mountain of gold the U.S. government was illegally confiscating. By 1936, the U.S. bullion depository at Fort Knox was completed, and in January 1937, the gold began to flow into it. The ripoff of the ages was about to proceed. In 1935, once the gold had all been turned in, the official price of gold was suddenly raised to $35 per ounce. But the catch was, only foreigners could sell their gold at the new higher price. The money changers, who had heeded Warburg's note and gotten out of the stock market just before the crash and bought gold at $20.66 per ounce, then shipped it to London, could now bring it back and sell it back to the government, nearly doubling their money while the average American starved. The Fort Knox Bullion Depository sits here in the middle of the Fort Knox Military Reservation, 30 miles southwest of Louisville, Kentucky. This was as close as we were permitted to get to the depository despite years of letters from members of Congress to allow our film crew inside.
The 4-acre grounds immediately surrounding the building are guarded by an electrified steel fence. An open moat and 4 machine gun armed guard pillboxes at the structure's corners. When the gold began arriving on January 13, 1937, there was unprecedented security. Thousands of official guests watched the arrival of a 9-car train from Philadelphia, guarded by armed soldiers, postal inspectors, Secret Service men, and guards from the U.S. Mint. It was all great theater. America's gold supply from across the land had been pooled, supposedly for the public benefit, and then safely tucked into Fort Knox. But all that security would soon be breached by the government itself.
Now the stage was set for a really big war, one which would pile up debt far beyond that of World War I.
For example, in 1944 alone, the U.S. national income was only $183 billion, yet $103 billion was spent on the war. This was 30 times the spending rate during World War I. In fact, the American taxpayer picked up 55% of the total Allied cost of the war. But equally important, virtually every nation involved in World War II greatly multiplied their debt. In the U.S., for example, federal debt went from $43 billion in 1940 up to $257 billion in 1950, an increase of 598%. Between 1940 and 1950, Japanese debt swelled 1,348%. French debt grew 583%, and Canadian debt soared 417%.
After the war, the world was now divided into 2 economic camps, communist command economies on the one hand versus monopoly capitalists on the other, set to fight it out in one perpetual and highly profitable arms race. It was finally time for the central bankers to embark in earnest on their 3-step plan to centralize the economic system of the entire world and finally bring about their global government or New World Order. The phases of this plan were: Step 1, central bank domination of national economies worldwide. Step 2, centralized regional economies through organizations such as the European Monetary Union and regional trade unions such as NAFTA. Step 3, centralize the world economy through a world central bank, a world money, and ending national independence through abolition of all tariffs by treaties like GATT. Step 1 was completed long ago. Steps 2 and 3 are far advanced, nearing completion. What about gold? Among central banks, the largest holder of gold is now the IMF. It and central banks now control 2/3 of the world's gold supply, giving them the ability to manipulate the gold market. Remember the money changer's golden rule: he who has the gold makes the rule. But before we get into solutions to our problem, let's take a look at what happened to all that gold in Fort Knox. Because if we don't understand that the gold has been stolen, we'll allow ourselves to be stampeded into the wrong solution, a gold-backed currency.
Most Americans still believe that the gold is still here at Fort Knox. At the end of World War II, Fort Knox contained over 700 million ounces of gold, an incredible 70% of all the gold in the world. How much remains? No one knows, despite the fact that federal law requires an annual physical audit of Fort Knox gold. The Treasury has consistently refused to conduct one. The truth is that a reliable audit of whatever remains here has not been conducted since President Eisenhower ordered one in 1953.
Where did America's gold in Fort Knox go? Over the years, it was sold off to European money changers at the $35 per ounce price. Remember, this was during a time when it was illegal for Americans to buy any of their own gold from Fort Knox. In fact, there was a very infamous case where the Firestone family set up a string of dummy corporations to purchase Fort Knox gold and keep it in Switzerland, never hitting U.S. shores. They were eventually caught, however, and successfully prosecuted. Finally, by 1971, all the pure gold had been secretly removed
finally making it legal once again for Americans to buy gold. Naturally, gold prices immediately began to soar. 9 years later, gold sold for $880 per ounce, 25 times what the gold in Fort Knox was sold for. One would think that eventually someone in the government would get wind of what was happening and blow the whistle. The largest fortune in the history of the world stolen. Shades of the old James Bond film, Goldfinger. Well, as a matter of fact, Ian Fleming, the author of the James Bond series, was head of the British Counterintelligence Service, MI5.
Some believe in the intelligence community that he wrote much of his fiction as a warning, as many authors of fiction do.
If the removal of all the good delivery gold from Fort Knox can be viewed as a deliberate raid on the U.S. Treasury, then such an operation might well have been years in the making, namely 40 years. Certainly enough time for Fleming to get wind of it and try to prevent it.
So just how did the story of the Fort Knox gold robbery get out?
It all started with an article in a New York periodical in 1974. The article charged that the Rockefeller family was manipulating the Federal Reserve to sell off Fort Knox gold at bargain basement prices to anonymous European speculators. 3 days later, the anonymous source of the story, Louise Auchincloss Boyer, mysteriously fell to her death from the window of her 10th floor apartment in New York. How would Mrs. Boyer have known of the Rockefeller connection to the Fort Knox gold heist? She was the longtime secretary of Nelson Rockefeller.
For the next 14 years, this man, Ed Durrell, a wealthy Ohio industrialist, devoted himself to a quest for the truth concerning the Fort Knox gold. He wrote thousands of letters to over 1,000 government and banking officials, trying to find out how much gold was really left and where the rest of it had gone.
Edith Roosevelt, the granddaughter of President Teddy Roosevelt, questioned the actions of the government in a March 1975 edition of the New Hampshire Sunday News.
Allegations of missing gold from our Fort Knox vault are being widely discussed in European financial circles. But what is puzzling is that the administration is not hastening to demonstrate conclusively that there is no cause for concern over our gold treasure, if indeed it is in a position to do so.
Unfortunately, Ed Durrell never did accomplish his primary goal, a full audit of the gold reserves in Fort Knox. It's incredible that the world's greatest treasure has had little accounting or auditing. This gold belonged to the American people, not the Federal Reserve and their foreign owners. One thing is certain. The government could blow all of this speculation away in a few days with a well-publicized audit under the searing lights of media cameras. It has chosen not to do so. One must conclude that they are afraid of the truth such an audit would reveal. What is the government so afraid of? Here's the answer. When President Ronald Reagan took office in 1981, his conservative friends urged him to study the feasibility of returning to a gold standard as the only way to curb government spending. It sounded like a reasonable alternative, so President Reagan appointed a group of men called the Gold Commission to study the situation and report back to Congress. What Reagan's Gold Commission reported back to Congress in 1982 was the following shocking revelation concerning gold. The U.S. Treasury owned no gold at all. All the gold that was left in Fort Knox was now owned by the Federal Reserve, a group of private bankers, as collateral against the national debt. The truth of the matter is that never before has so much money been stolen from the hands of the general public and put into the hands of a small group of private investors, the money changers. I'm standing in front of the headquarters of the International Monetary Fund, located in Washington, D.C. Across the street, right over there, is the headquarters of the World Bank. What are these organizations, and who controls them, and most importantly, Are they about to create a huge worldwide depression? Let us step back in time for a moment to the aftermath of World War I. People were tired of war, so under the guise of peacemaking, the international bankers devised a plan to consolidate power even further. Claiming only an international government would stem the tide of world wars, the money changers pushed forward a proposal for world government which stood on three legs. A world central bank to be called the Bank of International Settlements, a world judiciary to be called the World Court located in The Hague, the Netherlands, and a world executive and legislature to be called the League of Nations.
As President Clinton's mentor, Georgetown historian Carol Quigley, wrote in his 1966 book, Tragedy and Hope,
"The powers of financial capitalism had a far-reaching plan, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreement arrived at in frequent meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Bale, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central bank, which were themselves private corporations. Each central bank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world."
Despite intense pressure from the international bankers and the press, a handful of U.S. senators, led by Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, kept the U.S. out of these schemes. Without U.S. participation, the League was doomed. Incredibly, even though the U.S. rejected the World Central Bank, the BIS, the New York Federal Reserve ignored its government and arrogantly sent representatives to Switzerland to participate in the central bankers' meeting right up until 1994, when the U.S. was finally officially dragged into it. Their world government schemes thwarted, the bankers resorted to the old formula, another war to wear down the resistance to world government while reaping handsome profits. To this end, Wall Street helped resurrect Germany through the Thyssen Bank, which were affiliated with the Harriman interest in New York. Just as the Chase Bank had assisted in the financing of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia during World War I, Chase Bank was controlled by the Rockefeller family. Subsequently, it was merged with Warburg's Manhattan Bank to form the Chase Manhattan Bank. Now this has merged with Chemical Bank of New York, making it the largest Wall Street bank. Their strategy worked. Even before World War II was over, world government was back on track.